Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
If banks want to be private, then they should be private and they should guarantee their money themselves and not expect any public backing at all. At the moment, we've got a hybrid structure, which is a commercial benefit, a private rescue. And that is just unacceptable. So there's no case really for any public guarantee of a private banking system.
She's talking about the prospect that the UK would nationalize its equivalent of our Wall Street banks. Can you imagine? JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, all nationalized just because they ruined everything in our China shop and couldn't pay for the damage? Renowned economics professor and author Mary Mellor is our guest this week on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. And we'll be hearing from her and Ellen, who phoned in from Europe, to talk about how untenable our private banking system is as a public utility and how current talk about providing money directly to people, called quantitative easing for the people, or QEP, is appearing on both sides of the Atlantic. Perhaps we'll all soon get a raise. Hello and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, and the larger point is well taken and important. The requirement that people have money to participate in the economy they belong to is actually pretty obvious. Otherwise, everything breaks down. But then again, look around at the deterioration and lost opportunities that surround us, and you'll see why this discussion matters. We're in an endless crisis of too little civil credit. People have been cut out of the proceeds of our commonwealth. Time is running out on that arrangement, and this week's conversations will give you a look at why. Also this week, an auspicious gathering of American citizens at one of the 20th century's monetary landmarks, Bretton Woods. The Bretton Woods IV convocation is aiming to foster, quote, the redemption of our financial system and the restitution of our commonwealth, end quote. It's gathering right now at that bucolic spot at the foot of Mount Washington, New Hampshire. We'll talk for a few minutes with the noted founder of this event, Stuart Sinclair Weeks. And later, Matt Stannard's public banking report has some pointed comments about money and morality. But let's connect now with Ellen Brown, who is in Switzerland doing author-expert things at an economics conference.
Your latest article called The Nuclear Option, as if you're turning the world upside down to create some new source of funding for the people. Tell us about that.
Well, the whole title was Time for the Nuclear Option, Raining Money on Main Street. And I was picking up from a Zero Hedge article, which was called It Begins, Australia's Largest Investment Bank Just Said Helicopter Money is 12 to 18 months away. So they're using helicopter money pejoratively as if this is a terrible thing. But from the point of view of us money reformers, it's a good thing that that's actually what we need. And it's not just this Australian investment bank who said so. Basically, all other options have failed. The quantitative easing has failed, that we're in a deflationary spiral, like deflation is getting worse, and this is largely because all money, as we now know, is created by banks, and they create it in response to demand for credit. So people are no longer taking out loans. They're now trying to pay down their loans. They're all borrowed up. They're in debt as far as they can go, and this is also true for local governments, for businesses, et cetera. I mean, businesses would like to take out reasonable loans, but now we have a problem with the local banks. It has so many regulations on them that they can't make reasonable loans to small business. So credit is tightening, and when credit tightens, that is when the money supply shrinks. So we have a shrinking money supply. There's not enough money out there to conduct trade. You need, like, money is the blood of the economy, and we're short of blood. There's not enough blood to keep things moving and to get the wheels of the economy going. So it was not only the Australian Investment Bank, but Willem Buiter, who's the chief economist at Citigroup, also said that the conventional options have come to the end of the line, and so it may be time to try helicopter money. And he actually used the words helicopter money, dropped by China, the euro area, the UK, and the US, and debt restructuring could mitigate debt and actually get things moving again.
Well, the helicopter money reference goes back to Milton Friedman's statement decades ago.
And he was being a bit pejorative, too, but he said, of course, the way to cure a deflation, a shrinking money supply, is to just drop some more money out there. What he actually said was that all other things being equal, in other words, if supply remains the same, et cetera, this will drive up prices. So everybody took that to mean it would be inflationary. But all other things are not equal at all. When you dump money into a system that's short of money, what happens is the system gets moving again. So you actually have more supply, which then meets the demand. So supply and demand come out the same, so prices remain stable. And you have a lot more productivity going on, and people get jobs, et cetera. So good things actually happen.
And we're talking about debt-free money. People are not expanding their debt limits to be able to acquire more money. We're talking about just giving money debt-free.
Well, we could be talking about two things. Debt-free money, that would be my preferred option, is a national dividend where they're actually dropping money into the wallets of people. Something like, I calculated you could give people $1,000 a month, give everybody $1,000 a month, and it would cost $3 trillion a year. But at the same time, all those people, if they actually spend it, that will generate $3 trillion in GDP. But you get the money back in taxes, because when you put a dollar out there, in a good economy, it circulates seven times. And each of those people, assuming when it circulates, that means you spent it. So you spent it on some good or service. So all those goods and services generate taxes. And the average tax are close to 25% of GDP. So it only has to circulate four times to get the money back in taxes, theoretically. So that would be one ideal. But what more people are talking about, and what we'll probably see first, what Jeremy Corbyn is talking about in England, would be money that is interest-free, essentially. Make it a loan, but it's a loan from your own central bank, created out of nothing, and you don't owe interest on it. And then, as in the 1930s, the proceeds from what you build will pay back the loan. So that's one option. But another option is just to give the money to the Treasury, or let the Treasury just issue the money as they're entitled to do under the Constitution. Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof.
Of course, this stimulates then the knee-jerk reaction to, well, if you give people money, it's the slippery slope to moral depravity or slackness. It flies in the face of that ideology, and I suppose it means that it would be a hard road to pursue or to push it into existence.
Well, there have been a number of experiments, and that is not what happens. People become much more industrious. It gives them a little free time during which they can do things that are creative. And my vision would be that it would actually be an economic bill of rights where they could actually live on it as a starving student levels. In other words, maybe give them basic dormitory housing and a cafeteria, and then people have to work to help in the cafeteria or something, so that you could, if you wanted to, you could be a writer, an artist, an inventor, a musician, all those things that actually contribute to culture and contribute to furthering the beauty and the quality of life of people. And when they do that, for example, inventions, research and development can actually reduce the amount of resources that we have to use and make things more efficient, energy use more efficient, farming more efficient, and so forth. So that would be my vision, that you give people enough money, not enough that they become rich. If they want anything more elaborate than that, then they need to go get a job. but enough that if they want, if they have this creative urge and they just can't pursue it because they don't have the money, that they would have that option and we would bring out all this creativity in people.
Well, it certainly goes against the idea that money control be in the hands of a few, in which control is managed through wages and debt. Really a transformative moment from what we have seen and from really the whole Western banking model in the last couple hundred years, living in the slavery to that debt. And this, I think, certainly sets a different standard and a different context in which people are able to participate in the economy.
Whether it will happen, I don't know, but it's really a quite exciting prospect that so many people are talking about it and that conventional economists are recognizing that they've hit the end of the line. They've tried it all. They're down to the zero bound, you know, zero, virtually zero interest rates for banks, and it's not working. Their model is wrong. So it gives a chance for some new models, which we think we have.
a colossal collapse conclusion. Good. Well, we'll see what happens next, as I like to say. So thank you very much, Ellen, for that, and we'll look forward to seeing you here at the Bretton Woods event in the next week, and look forward to your conversation with Mary Meller on this as well.
Okay. It's my pleasure to be speaking with Mary Meller, Professor Emeritus at the University of Northumbria, Newcastle-upon-Tyne in the UK. Among a long list of achievements, she is a founding member of the World Economics Association and the author of 6 books. We met earlier this month at a money reform conference in Berlin, and I was very impressed with her thinking and writing. Her latest book is due out shortly. It's called Debt or Democracy: Public Money for Sustainability and Social Justice. It's great to be talking to you, Mary.
Pleased to be talking to you too, Ellen.
So the latest buzz on the money reform front in England is all about the recent election of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader. He has included quantitative easing for people in his platform, and his prospective finance minister, John McDonnell, wants public ownership of the banking system and a financial transaction tax, among other sweeping reforms. You're close to the scene and the players, so I would love to hear your take on whether they have a real chance and how it's playing out there.
Well, the first thing is that the landslide win by Jeremy Corbyn, while not unexpected because it had been building, it certainly wasn't expected at the beginning of the campaign. And what has surprised everybody is the groundswell of demand for change. Well, what that change is going to be, well, will have to be arranged to be revealed. But a starting point, of course, is the anti-austerity position of the Corbyn campaign, which has got great public resonance. But the other thing is the challenge to the neoliberal thinking, what I call handbag economics, that is the attack on the public sector, the idea that the public sector is totally reliant on the private sector, and the fact that the public has had to rescue the private sector, particularly through the creation of new money, quantitative easing. Money has been pumped into the banking and financial sector and merely caused inflation in stock market prices or high-end affluent accumulation. And people are just thinking, this was public money, this was public resources, and it has achieved virtually nothing. And they're starting to ask the question, well, why not quantitative easing for the people? Why not, instead of trying to put this money in through the financial sector, which is already riven by speculation and many other less savoury things, why not put the money directly into rebuilding the public sector and into public services? Even there was an article in one of our right-wing papers that was saying perhaps the time has come for people's quantitative easing. Perhaps it's the next thing that has to happen to get us back onto some kind of rational economic basis.
When he says quantitative easing for people, can you define exactly what his platform or program is?
Yeah. Well, what you've got to look at what the other quantitative easing was first. The other quantitative easing was, the starting point is that most new money in neoliberal societies, that is for the last 40 years or so, has only been able to be accessed through into the economy through debt. And Obviously, there are limitations to debt, and one is that people get to the point where they can take no more debt. Now, if your money supply is tied to people taking the money for personal consumption or student loans or mortgages or investing in a business, if that's your only way to get money into the economy and people just can't take any more, your money supply is tied up with your credit supply, your supply of debt, and they both go into a tailspin. They both start to contract. Less new money taking out, less money there to pay the old money off. And your money supply shrinks quite dramatically, which is what has happened after the crash. There was a huge boom in new money in the period from the 1970s up until the crash. And now you've had a reversal and the money supply is disappearing. So you've got to get new money in the system. Well, how do you do that? Obviously, you can't do it through the private sector itself because that's already saying that it can't take any more debt. So what happens is that you call up a power which any government has, any state has, which is the power to create new money. Now, this power to create new money in neoliberal economies is only vested in the central banks. And the central banks can just create money out of thin air, as can banks themselves, actually, but only as debt. But central banks have the unique power of being able to create new money free of debt. That is, they can create money it owes to nobody. Now, how does it use this money? In a neoliberal view of the economy, what happens is that they think, well, let's see if we can put more loose money, debt-free money, into the economy, into the banking sector, and then they'll lend it out to new businesses or consumption. So that was the thought behind the quantitative easing. That is, completely new electronic public money is created and pumped into the financial sector and into banks in the hope that it will come out the other end into investment in the economy. Now, that has been tried and tried and tried and tried. The Japanese have tried it over and over and over again, and it doesn't work because it's too slow. Plus, also, all the new money just goes into more and more and more high-level investment that doesn't reach the people. So the logical thing is to say, well, look, if the central banks can create new electronic money out of nothing, free of debt, why are we trying to use it to create more debt to the population? Why are we just trying to get it out into the economy as loans? Why don't we put the money into public investment, build houses, invest in railways? Even a lot of people are saying give money directly to people in various ways, find people into public employment. And that way you will get money very quickly into the economy, which can then go into the commercial sector and help people pay off their debts. So that is what the logic of people's quantitative easing is. It's finding a way of getting, in a crisis situation that we're in, of getting more money as quickly as possible into the economy so that we don't have to have this ridiculous imposition of austerity.
Well, I've seen several objections to this policy. Of course, I'm totally for it. I mean, I think it's great that he's pushing it.
I should say that the Corbyn camp is not exactly pushing it because I think this is such a new policy that I think they're beginning to gently explore the possibility because it is so different from all the neoliberal nostrums and the limitations. And the ideology of neoliberalism goes very deep, but we have an opportunity here, the beginnings of the opportunity to challenge it. And, this is the optimism of the moment. There is a space opening up, and really we have to take it to change the climate of the debate.
Right. At least it's a chance to get these ideas out there, which they rarely make it into the major media. But
that in itself may surprise us, that once these very, very rational and very necessary ideas that even people from the center ground are beginning to say is going to be necessary. Because, in fact, people's quantitative easing has been done. Australia, in response to the crisis, gave packets of money to its population. Even George Bush did a tax rebate, which was effectively putting money into people's banks. China's done it. Hong Kong did it. So it's not new. It has helped rectify the lack of money. So although it's new to places like particularly, even the US has done it more than Britain, it's Britain is the one that's been the most ideologically austerity-based. and the rest of the EU as well, as we've seen. So there is the chance here to do it. I think Jeremy Corbyn was surprised by the strength of the support for him. I mean, it really was a landslide by loads and loads of people registering as Labour supporters and members in order to be able to vote. My feeling is that his aim is to open up the debate, to change the agenda, to make the a successful challenge to neoliberal economic thinking, what I call handbag economics. And I think that his aim is to open up the debate. And I think if he achieved that, he would consider that to be a success. We have to admit that he is 66 already, which means he'd be 71 by the time of the next election, and 76 if he did a full term. We don't tend in Britain to have such... usually our prime ministers are a bit younger than that. My feeling is he may see how he feels in a couple of years' time, if he's changed the agenda, if he's opened up the debate, if he's got the thing moving, he may consider that's his job done. Or he may decide to stay on and carry it through. I think that's up to him how fit he feels and whether he wants to stay the course. His short-term aim, the aim he's expressed in standing for election in the first place was to open the debate, and he's already achieved that. He's opening the debate. We'll have to see how far we can take the debate and how far we can change the economic agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I've seen a number of objections in your media to this whole idea. One is that it will lead to Zimbabwe-style hyperinflation, that it's not sterilized, it's fiscal policy and not monetary policy, and it's not really quantitative easing, which is supposedly just an asset swap where you have the central bank pays cash for federal securities or mortgage-backed securities on the bank's books, and then they can swap them back if the inflation goes up. But if you actually spend money on infrastructure or put money in people's pockets, you can't get it back, so then you're going to cause inflation. So what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, the situation we're facing at the moment is deflation. The papers are full of it. Even this morning, there's going to be a third global downturn, a third global crisis, the first one being the Anglo-Saxon one, the second one being the Eurozone, and now we've got an emerging markets crisis coming. So I think the first thing is inflation is nowhere near on the agenda. We're more likely to see deflation, and therefore that is why a lot of people across the spectrum are beginning to look at this strategy. Because don't forget, Milton Friedman advocated helicopter money in a crisis. So there's nothing, as it were, left-wing about this. How you spend the money is a political question, but whether you need to can be quite a technical question. It's just a question that the money supply is so short that you're in danger of going into a downward spiral. So I think we can dismiss all those scare tactics. It's really cheap economics. It's ill thought out, knee-jerk economics to talk about Zimbabwe and Weimar. They're two very different situations. Weimar, anyway, wasn't a public. The central bank wasn't public. It had been privatized by the Allies, and therefore it was under a private regime that the hyperinflation happened, and it was put to an end by a re-establishment of a public central bank and a new public currency. So the idea that it was the state that caused the problem is completely mistaken, and even a paper from the IMF has admitted that. And Zimbabwe, well, the economy was broken, and therefore it wasn't the money supply that caused the hyperinflation. It was the crash of the economy that caused the hyperinflation. But what people don't realize is that quantitative easing has been happening all over the place, particularly in Japan, without causing inflation. In fact, Japan cannot get its economy into inflation. It would be delighted if it could. So we're not fighting the danger of inflation. We're fighting the danger of deflation. Therefore, well, the other factor is that one of the things that's always under attack from the neoliberals is a deficit, a public sector deficit, too much what I call surplus expenditure. But you need surplus expenditure. You need a deficit. As I've said to you in a previous point, that I think the commercial sector needs a public deficit to create debt-free money to enable it to balance its books. And therefore, our fear shouldn't be the public sector issuing money. It should be that there is not sufficient money in the system for the commercial sector to even run under its own principles, because it constantly runs short of money, because, it, as I said, it's based on debt. So this idea of inflation as the sort of scaremonger of inflation is completely ill thought out, and it's just as I say, knee-jerk economics, and that is not the danger at all. Most countries have always had public debts and public deficits, and there's a good reason for that, because the commercial economy needs it. Otherwise, if we didn't need it, then all national economies would be in surplus, and that isn't the case hardly anywhere around the world. So we're looking at the economies from the wrong end of a telescope. And I think tax is completely underestimated as a monetary instrument. It is the main monetary instrument. If you've got too much money in the economy, then the logical way is to tax it out in a progressive way, so that the people who can most bear the burden take it, and you don't put the burden on the people who can least take it. And therefore, there's always taxation as the way to remove money from the economy. Putting out government debt just gives more benefit to the rich that the poor have to pay out of their taxes. So tax is by far the best monetary instrument an economy has.
And if they actually did nationalize the banking system, as John McDonnell is proposing, that you'd get a lot of money there by the interest would go back to the government instead of going into the pockets of big banks or offshore tax havens or wherever it's going now. That would be a big chunk of income.
Absolutely. Well, not only that, it's questionable whether the high street banks should in any case be in the private sector, because, as has been shown by the financial crisis, they are nearly 100% guaranteed by the public economy itself. So if the public sector has in the crisis to fully 100% back its banking sector, then it's not a private sector organisation anyway. So a lot of people are arguing that the idea of commercial banks that are publicly guaranteed is a complete anomaly. And if banks want to be private, then they should be private and they should guarantee their money themselves and not expect any public backing at all. At the moment, we've got a hybrid structure, which is a commercial benefit, a private rescue. And that is just unacceptable. So there's no case really for any public guarantee of a private banking system.
Another objection to quantitative easing for people is that it violates EU rules. Article 123 of the Lisbon Treaty forbids central banks from printing money to finance government spending. So how would you get around that?
Rescind that rule. The failure of the Eurozone and the European Central Bank is because it is the ultimate neoliberal, set under neoliberal ideological auspices. And it shows its complete failure, and it's the endless rolling crisis it's involved with shows that you cannot have a banking system that has no public element. And the Eurozone proves this out and out. And in fact, they've had to adopt quantitative easing, and they're having to directly or indirectly buy government debt. So the idea that you could have a money system that only issued money through the commercial sector, that is, as private borrowing, was just untenable and always would be untenable, because it only has a debt-based. All its money issue can only be based on people taking on debt. And as I said before, there's three problems with having your money supply through debt. One is socially very, very divisive, because only the most speculative and the people who have the most behind them already take most of the money, as we've seen in Britain particularly. Most of the borrowing has been done by the financial sector itself. Because you've based all your money system on debt, it's environmentally unsustainable, because it drives, in boom times, unsustainable levels of consumption. And it's economically unviable because anything based on debt must eventually run out of steam when people can take no more debt. So the Eurozone was set up on neoliberal principles that are completely unsustainable and always were. And it's having now to retrofit itself, really, with the proper conditions of a public banking and money and banking sector, which is to have a very strong, very supportive public element.
Yeah, Article 123 of the Maastricht Treaty is so blatantly opposed to any sort of public money. Basically, it says any type of credit facility with the European Central Bank or with the national central bank in favor of union institutions, bodies, offices, or agencies, central governments, regional, local, or other public authorities shall be prohibited. In other words, they can't get credit from the local governments, cannot get credit from the central bank or their own central banks, only private banks.
Yeah, but I don't think, now this is where we'll probably differ from the people's quantitative easing as it's being put forward now. I wouldn't have the central bank making loans to quantitatively ease the public sector. I would say that the money should be issued and circulated free of debt and balanced by, if necessary, increased taxation. That is, what any money system needs is a significant sector that is free of debt. Otherwise, it will always run into the sand. And obviously, if money is being issued free of debt, you're not going to give that to people on a private basis because that would be totally unfair. So if you are going to issue money that is debt-free and circulate a proportion of your money debt-free, which I think any money system has to do, then it's only fair it's done on a public basis, on a democratic basis, and on a fair basis. And that means that it must have a substantial public benefit element to it.
That's a really good point, because I'm just looking at Article 123. Overdraft facilities or any other type of credit facility, basically with governments, is forbidden. So the solution is, say, fine, we're not going to do it as a loan or as credit. We're just going to give it away. The central bank could give it away.
Well, that's what Milton Friedman said, and he's not considered to be a radical economist. Helicopter money would only be fair, of course, if it fell on everybody equally. But the point is, calling it helicopter money, it is money free of debt. So if somebody like Milton Friedman admits that at some point in the operating of your money system you have to have a debt-free element, then we need to explore that and ask, well, how much of a debt-free element? And I think it should be a substantial part, because that's the only way to get a fair allocation of the benefit of being able to access new money in an economy. At the moment, as I said, it's the private speculators who are mainly accessing the new money, or people who are taking out mortgages, which is just bidding up the price of houses. And in fact, what is so interesting in Britain, and really not much commented upon, is that we've had 40 years of neoliberalism and the financialization and the financial sector in the driving seat. And what that has achieved is turned us from a nation of homeowners, which the right wing were very proud of in the 1970s. I think we had coming up to 70% home ownership. And now we're a nation of private renters. And home ownership is, for the first time, dropping quite substantially, as even quite professional people are locked out of the housing market. And I think if this is one thing that Jeremy Corbyn should throw at the Conservatives, is how have you managed to see a decline in what is seen as the most conservative thing, the right to own your own house, the idea of the property owner is at the centre of market economics. And yet neoliberalism has totally destroyed it in this country and put it really beyond the reach of most people, or a substantial number of people, which I think is amazing and deserves more political comment.
Excellent point. Your book that's coming out shortly is called Debt or Democracy, Public Money for Sustainability and Social Justice. It makes the case for democratization of money and the need to reclaim the right to create public money for public purposes. What do you mean exactly by the democratization of money?
Well, there's only two sources of new money in an economy. The public central banks, whether they're privately owned like the Fed or not, they're still doing a public job, which is to produce the public currency. And new public money is also, new currency is also produced through the banking sector when they make loans. They can't create notes and coins, but they can create bank accounts which are nominated in the public currency. That is, they are dollar accounts or pound accounts or euro accounts. And as soon as the private banking sector makes a loan and says this is dollars or pounds or euros, then that becomes a liability on the public central bank because it's nominated in the national currency. Now, I think this is totally undemocratic because it means that whoever does most of the borrowing accesses most of the new public currency. So that is where a debt base of money issue through the commercial banking system is unsustainable. And therefore, that's the debt element. So my democratic element is if money is being created out of nothing, not borrowed from somebody else, but out of nothing, in the name of the people, that is their currency, the dollar, the pound, the euro, then why don't the people have a say about who creates that money, how they create it, who it's allocated to, how it's spent? It should be a democratic question. So my first point about democracy is we must have a debate about our money system and who controls it. That can open up the agenda as to whether it should be controlled as it is now, mainly through the banking sector, issued as debt, or whether we want more public money publicly created for public purposes. So my point about democracy is, firstly, we need to have a democratic debate. Then we need to decide how much of our money supply should be made democratically available for public purposes as people democratically decide. Now, people may democratically decide that the banks is perfectly all right as it is and the banks should have all the new money to issue as debt. That might be the decision, but I think if people were exposed to the choice, I doubt it would be their decision.
You also noted that questions about public money have largely been ignored by both right and left. For the left, the whole question is an irrelevance to the wider critique of capitalism. I guess that may be changing with Corbyn's leadership, but I've noticed that too. It's strange that in the U.S., it seems to be the Tea Partiers who are all over the Fed and all over monetary reform, and what they want is to go back to the gold standard, and that the left hasn't taken much interest in it, whereas you would think they would, because it sounds sort of like a left-leaning socialist idea to give the power of money back to the people. So why do you think that is, or what's the objection, or why did Marx himself not go for?
Because Marx had rather a traditional view of money. He shared the kind of the general myths of money, what I've called in the book as the myths of money, which are that money emerged out of barter, that money was originally gold, and all the historical evidence shows that this isn't true, that there's never been any barter societies based on barter. Most currencies across the world haven't been based on gold, more substantially in Europe on silver, but even then, never pure silver. And the reason is quite simple. If you have got a precious metal currency in small enough denominations to buy your daily bread or to pay your week's rent, the coin would be so small that it would just get lost. And therefore, money has always been basically either base metal or some other material, paper, wood. But Marx, unfortunately, because he was writing in the high point of coinage era, he adopted this rather mythology of the preciousness of the coinage. And so when it came to coinage, he had quite traditional views. But he did note the other side of the money system, and that is the importance of credit. And he was beginning in Capital to touch on the role of credit in the establishment of capitalism, which is another aspect of money, of course. Money is credit. And I think he would have developed this idea, but I think that those picking up on the Marxist analysis of labour and exploitation have just underestimated particularly the importance of the role of credit in getting capitalism established, that is the ability to create the ability through promises to get hold of resources themselves, which is what credit is. Credit is when you don't have the resources, but you use the promise of future payment to get hold of resources, that is physical capital, in various ways. So I think that's been underestimated. And then the importance of having a public currency to make the profit realizable, because unless you've got a circulating medium, then you can't actually extract your profit from the process of exchange. So I think that the Marxist left has just missed the whole analysis of money and credit. I mean, they don't ignore it completely, but I would argue that, in fact, I do argue that it played a much, much more substantial role in the establishment of capitalism than has generally been recognised. So I think that would be the position for more left analysis to incorporate the idea of the analysis of money and credit. I think for the Labour position, coming back to Corbyn and the Labour Party, I don't think they're coming from a hardline Marxist position. They're coming from a broad left economic analysis, which again has not paid much attention to the money system. It hasn't seen it as a substantial part of the public sector. When supporting a public economy, they're still thinking in terms of taxing the rich, which I've no objection to taxing the rich, but I think they've seen money as emerging out of the commercial sector, whereas in fact I would argue that money emerges out of the public sector and then it is captured and harnessed by the commercial sector. So I think the problem for the left broadly is that they just had no analysis of money, and some analysis of credit, but no analysis of money.
Well, I think that's probably because the whole issue has been so obscured. I mean, the whole idea that banks are simply intermediaries, as you point out, they're not. They actually create the money. And now the Bank of England has admitted that. But up till now, they were saying, no, they're just doing a service, you know, taking in deposits and lending them out again. And so if the government were to do that, they'd just be going into a competing business, or, you know, it just looks like a business, but it's not. They're actually creating the money, which when you realize that, then clearly that should be in the public domain, or it seems clear to people, most people, when they realize that.
Well, I mean, this is the odd thing. People are quite happy to say that the commercial sector is this source of wealth. It's the most important sector. We can't do without it. We must let it have its head. We mustn't compete with it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you ask people where they think money comes from, the public currency, they'll say, well, that comes from the state. So they're quite happy people are quite happy with the concept of public money because they do see the money as public. And they also, in the end, see the very public relation to money. I was very remarkable when we had our first sign of the crisis in 2007. One of our small banks, Northern Rock, which had been a social bank, but it had become sold out and privatized as a commercial bank, it failed. And the people started queuing around the block for the first time for more than 100 and more years. People had queued around the block to get their money out of a bank. And the chief executive of the bank tried to say, everything's all right, there's plenty of money, you don't need to worry, and nothing happened. The Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, then strode up and said, don't worry, the Bank of England's behind you, everything's all right, which is supposed to be what saves the banks, is the central bank is supposed to be the one that bails out the banks, but the people still carried on queuing. It wasn't until the Chancellor of the Exchequer, that is the government itself, Alistair Darling, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer, stood up and said, the government's behind you, that people went home. So that shows that people know that in the end, the only backing to the public money system, to the monetary system, is the public sector itself. And of course, the public sector is the public. So the only thing that guarantees the money in any economy is the public itself, the public willingness to trust themselves, to trust each other, and to honour each other's debts, and honour each other's money. And that showed quite clearly that money is a public issue, not a private issue.
You said it also clearly. I'm really looking forward to reading your new book, Debt or Democracy, Public Money for Sustainability and Social Justice. I guess we've come to the end of our time, but do you have any like websites you want to mention or anything else you want people to know?
All I want people to do is to start thinking about, is to exercise democracy over the money system, to start asking fundamental questions about where money comes from, who owns and controls it, how it enters the economy, how it leaves the economy, who can get hold of it, who can't get hold of it, and then from that knowledge to make a democratic decision as to how they want their money system to work. So really what I want is for people to reclaim what I consider to be a public resource for themselves and for the social betterment and of their society. And that's great. The only aim I had in writing the book.
Yeah, great. But we want people to be able to get your book. So is it available?
It's due
Amazon
out at the beginning of November. Due out at the beginning of November. Pluto Press. Yeah, the first week of November.
Okay, great.
So not long now. Also, I've got some lectures on understanding money on YouTube. So if anybody wants to, those were done two or three years ago. So some of my thinking's moved on since then. But it'll be a good introduction to the background to the previous book, which is called The Future of Money, from financial crisis to public resource, which was my analysis of the crisis and why I begin the argument about why we should have money as a democratic resource. And this new book sets out the whole mechanisms and analysis as to how that could be the case or how that could be done.
Well, it's been really great talking to you.
And it's great meeting you, Ellen, I hope good sense around money will prevail.
Yeah, I do think that is the problem, that people just don't understand it. And so the more we get information out there, the more they understand, then the grass will start waving in the same direction and we'll have our grass movement, you know, coming up from the bottom.
Yep, that is the aim, and I hope that is the case. And I hope that Corbyn in Britain does achieve what he wants to do, which is to open the agenda. If he just opens the agenda, let alone fills the agenda, but as long as he opens the agenda and asks some of these fundamental questions, I think that will be a job well done.
Yeah, it gives us all a chance to jump in and write about it. I'll do that. My next article at Beyondist, I think.
Absolutely.
Okay, so great talking to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. I've been speaking with Mary Miller, Professor Emeritus at the University of Northumbria, and the author of 6 books, the latest of which is Debt or Democracy, Public Money for Sustainability and Social Justice, due out early next month.
The famed Bretton Woods Mount Washington Hotel is best remembered for the pivotal global monetary conferences in the 20th century that made sea change decisions about the accepted international values of money, agreements relating to trade, and later the institution of new global monetary institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. It was ground zero for the launch of a new era of monetary control. This week, that focus is being modified by a gathering called the Bretton Woods IV Convocation, a calling together of not international monetary interests, but rather a gathering of people from a wide range of communities and tribes who have lived with the effects of a monetary system that prioritizes profits over the primacy of public interest. The objective is to open a new conversation and awareness about the nature and importance of our true commonwealth. The founder of this week-long event is Stuart Sinclair Weeks. He's a generational descendant of a key actor in the United States' own monetary saga, the creation of the Federal Reserve.
So my great-grandfather was considered by President Wilson to be the most knowledgeable representative of his congressman or senator in his time in Washington. He was a member of the United States Senate. And he ended up becoming one of the central actors in one of the central dramas of our age, which was the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. And he had said that he wasn't sure one could get a good bill out of it, but he gave his best. Specifically, he contributed over 400 amendments to the Federal Reserve Act, and then he had a decision he had to make. And that is, will I vote for it or not? And I think with all due respects, when he cast the vote, he forgot who he was, because his comment was that from a businessman's perspective, it has more good than ill. And he voted for the Federal Reserve Act with these 400 amendments. As it turned out, Wilson, the chair of the Senate and House Banking Currency Committees, Glass, William Jennings Bryan, that is all the major advocates for the Federal Reserve Act, said in retrospect that it was one of the greatest mistakes they'd ever made.
The original Bretton Woods gathering, which occurred about 30 years after the start of the Federal Reserve, built upon the new organizational strength of global monetary powers. It was the start of a new era of international finance in which the management and control of money became an institutional lever over populations and markets.
At Bretton Woods in 1944, interesting enough, with 44 nations, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund were established. And what I would say occurred was that we further globalized our debt-based monetary system, which was established or formalized with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. And so the task we are taking up, if at Bretton Woods we further globalize our debt-based monetary system, what can we do about that? What we're called to do is to do our best to develop a non-debt-based monetary system.
The Bretton Woods IV convocation has an agenda for action.
We're doing that in the form of the North Country, that is, the Northern Part of New Hampshire, the North Country Action Plan, and it has four cornerstones. And those cornerstones are something called the North Country Resolution, which proposes that communities fund their next duly authorized public works project publicly, at cost. Number two, we are speaking about the value and significance of local currencies. Number three is the initiative that you're involved in, which is public banking, banking in the public interest. This also goes back to John Wingate Weeks, who said if we don't have a central bank controlled by the government, he meant overseen by the government, and by government he meant public servants, we're going to have what would amount to a central bank controlled by a few interests in the city of New York and Boston. So I think this public banking initiative is very important, and I think perhaps the only way it's going to arise is the way it arose in North Dakota, that is really through educating the citizenry, going from community to community to community and really helping people understand what is meant by money is the lifeblood of our nation. That is, it's our lifeblood, it's our commonwealth. And that as long as it's controlled by private interests, then it's going to serve minority self-selected private interests at the tremendous and growing expense of the public.
More information about this week's Bretton Woods IV convocation is available at brettonwoodsiv.org. That's Bretton Woods, small I, small v, .org.
Today, I'm contemplating the morality of money. Our morality, our money. I'm Matt Stannard. This is the Public Banking Report. Poor shaming is still all the rage among American politicians who don't understand how money or morality work. The latest example comes to us from Lewiston, Maine, where unpopular Mayor Robert McDonald recently called for the public shaming of welfare recipients by publishing their names and addresses on the internet. What could go wrong there? I hope, he said, that this makes people think twice about applying for welfare. Now, I'll give you some time to go wash the vomit out of your mouth, seriously. But apart from its genuine mean-spiritedness, what's wrong with Mayor McDonald's advocacy is that it assumes people are poor due to some kind of moral failing. We know better. We know that we've entrusted our economic decision-making to elites who externalize the costs of their own bad decisions, trap our cities into bad financial deals, and then manipulate the media into blaming the poor for those decisions. In light of that, there's something very promising about the recent advocacy of people like Jeremy Corbyn, the labor leader in Britain, and our own Ellen Brown. Some people call it quantitative easing for the people. Others call it overt money financing, a more accurate term for putting money directly into the economy, moreover, creating that money. Even Milton Friedman, the most well-known champion of free markets in the 20th century, advocated overt money financing. Think about that. Milton Friedman proposed Keynesianism on steroids. Understanding why this is moral requires first understanding why this is possible, because money is a construct. It's real, but we're the ones who create it. We create it collectively and institutionally. As the folks at Positive Money tell us, banks do not just take pre-existing money and lend it on. They create credit, bank assets, and matching money or other bank liabilities, which did not previously exist. And by loans of longer maturity than their deposits, they create purchasing power in the economy. And here's where this gets important. As a moral and political question, Positive Money continues, saying, if banks can create purchasing power, it matters a lot how much they create and to whom that purchasing power is allocated. And that's important, because the big bankers want us to think that we can't control our own money, our own exchange, our own management of credit and value. So they insist that creating new money to stimulate the real, on-the-ground economy must result in inflation. But it won't. Adding new money to an economic system won't make prices go up until production and demand are at capacity. Alan Brown estimates that the money supply in the United States could be increased by $1 trillion annually without causing inflation. But the larger issue here is simply that the elites want us to think that we can't fix any problems without them. And as David Graeber writes in the concluding section of Debt, the First 5,000 Years, to begin to free ourselves, the first thing we need to do is to see ourselves as historical actors, as people who can make a difference in the course of world events. And it's our history and our money. I'm Matt Stannard.
That does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. If you'd like to stay current with Ellen's writing and commentary, visit ellenbrown.com. And if you'd like to know more about public banking and related developments around the country, please visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Visit them on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Public Banks Now. Our thanks to our guest today, and especially to our committed sponsors at Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to economic justice and fairness and the creation of new American public banks. Payment Management offers complimentary analysis of your current credit card needs and expenses at paymentmgmt.com. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.